I think I do want to say to the audience that these remarks that I make are specific. And they are specific to my own experience, and I do not presume to speak for all Chinese or all other Asians in this country. One of the most vivid examples I can give is my direct experience in high school, where I can safely say I was a miserable failure. Most of you in the literature, in the newspapers these past few years, I'm sure have read about how well so many of our Indo-Chinese, Vietnamese, and other Asian students, how well they are doing in the high schools. And I read that with a little longingness and wonder, well, I wish that might have been myself. But unfortunately, that was not true. So it's difficult to generalize, and I think perhaps my case study might even be more realistic, because out of a high school, there's only one valedictorian and many, many others, and a whole group of them in the lower quartile in the class. So that's where I was. And I could say that the setting of the stage for those early adolescent years were pretty depressing. In fact, I remember thinking desperately at one time, who wants to go on to college? God, four more years of anguish and pain. And so they were not optimistic years, they were depressing years, and my self-concept and self-confidence and ego probably was as low as anyone can have at that time. So that my going to Valparaiso University was quite a drastic and remarkable change. It was definitely something that I had intuitively sensed as a new life or a new opportunity. An opportunity to get away from home, to get away from a very, very oppressive and rejecting climate at home, into another world where I can perhaps make it on my own. And that basically was a very conscious and intentional decision on my part. I guess if people ask, well, how did you choose Valparaiso, or why Valparaiso University? Again, I think the influence of my pastor and a number of lay people in our congregation who already knew about Valparaiso was very important here. A number of them were very supportive and encouraging me to apply. And I did, and I said to myself, oh, they'll never accept me, not with my grades. And for one crazy reason or another, and this was even before the days of the civil rights movement and what is now better known as educational economic opportunities offices, EEO offices that now exist in universities for minority students. These all occurred before those days. I was admitted on probation, and oh, we thought that was wonderful. Good stroke of luck, I got in, you know. And I still remember the summer preceding my entry to Valparaiso University. I was a scout. As some of you might have known from my previous discussions from yesterday, I was very active in the scouts. And so I spent the summer in a Boy Scout camp as a scoutmaster. What we call at the 10 Mile River Scout Camp in Narrowsburg, New York, I was a provisional scoutmaster. That was a wonderful experience. That was where I received the letter from the admissions officer, Freddie Reckling, welcoming me to Valparaiso University. And I was so happy. Because back in 1952, the only real other option I had was going into the military. The draft was still on, some of you may still remember that. And so I went to Valpo, And I made a number of very, very significant decisions at that time. Now, when I look back, I'm not so sure if it was a good decision or not. But back in those days, number one, I said to myself, this is going to be a very important deal. I better keep a diary of all of this activity. So at Valparaiso, I kept a diary for 4 years, covering every day of my undergraduate years, recording my feelings and experiences and perceptions. And and the second thing I did was a conscious decision to cut off my ties with Chinatown. And that included all the friends that I had. And I went to Valparaiso with another boy from Chinatown, a fellow named Gilbert Chin, and Eugene Chin. In fact, there were three of us from Chinatown who went to Valparaiso that year. I think we were the biggest onslaught of Asians on that campus in 1952. Gilbert and Eugene wrote letters home constantly. And they would even get on the phone and call home constantly. And I, as I observed their behavior on campus there, I said, no, I don't want to do that. I think I want to make my life here for the next 4 years. And I stuck to that. In fact, the three of us agreed not to be roommates with one another. And I made a conscious effort then to really learn English. You all recall I went through 5 years of remedial speech in English. I spent 5 years at Brooklyn Tech already in high school. Didn't say that last night or yesterday. So I kept a daily diary, cut off home ties, and had wonderful experiences there, and probably will share a few with you there, a few of the significant highlights of my career at Valparaiso University. I don't think I did very well academically that first year. I think that first year for me was a transition year. And you know, when you're under probation, you need at least a C average to get off. And back in those years, you have to have, what, 2 years natural science, 2 years social science, 2 years English, 2 years foreign language, in my case, German, plus your major. And there's no deviation from these fixed curriculum. And, okay, 2 years of natural science, okay, which one can I pick, you know? Math, you flunk that. Well, let's try physics. Physics, you flunk that. Well, let's try chemistry. Chemistry, you flunk that, you know? My God, I'm cutting down my options, you know? And the only options that Valparaiso offered at that time that was left was biology and geology. So I chose biology one more time to see if you can make it. English. I had a wonderful roommate who I kept on getting all these F's and F's and F's in freshman composition and an occasional D. And my roommate, God bless his heart, his name is Eugene Vetter from Kenosha, Wisconsin. He's a Plymouth Brethren. And that was also my first introduction to other branches of the Christian church, other than the ones we had in Chinatown. Eugene was very, very much a strong Plymouth Brethren. He left the campus every weekend to go to church in Danville. He would hitchhike to Danville to worship with the Plymouth Brethren there. And he said his prayers every night. And I remember one night, I was laying down in a lower bunk bed and he slept above me. And I remember he forgot to say his prayers. So it was about midnight and I would whisper, "Dear Gene, you forgot to say your prayers," and, "Oh, I forgot," you know, and he would get up and then he would kneel and say his prayers. Eugene was a 4-point student. And he read my freshman compositions and says, "Jim," he says, "the only problems you're making is that you don't know where to put the commas. From now on," he says, if you have any doubts about whether you should be using a comma or a period, throw in a semicolon. You'll get away with it." So I did, and did you know what happened?
At work, I
began getting C's. Who knows what the rules of grammar are? I said, "I'm getting C's now, you know." And by the end of the second semester of freshman compositions, I began getting B's and A's. Still don't know my grammar, not even to this day. Even with a thesis in seminary, a dissertation with a PhD, still don't know my grammar. But I sure know how to use my semicolons. I got through. It was wonderful. In fact, in the second semester of freshman composition, when we were asked to write short stories and do a lot of creative techniques, I began really enjoying it because I'm a very creative guy, and began telling wonderful stories. Got through with a B in freshman composition in the second semester. That summer of my freshman year was a period for me to think things through very seriously, because up until that time, I couldn't say that I was a decent student, and was not a serious student, and I spent the summer as a camp counselor at Camp Sloan, which is a YMCA camp in the corner of Lakeville, Connecticut, which is right in the corner of the tri-state corner of Massachusetts, which is in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York, right in that little corner nestled in the Berkshire Mountains of New England. Beautiful place. My first parish was in that same county area, so there are fond memories there. And it was that summer when I read a number of novels and decided, "James, they did not kick you out. You've made it so far." In spite of the fact that I did not get the C average, Dr. Bauer, God bless his heart, decided to continue me on probation for one more semester. So I went back to Valpo in my sophomore year, took biology and a number of other courses in geography, etc., history, German, and probably forced myself to study in a way that I've never done before, nor have I done since. We had general biology text, and whenever I didn't understand a chapter, I would go to the library and pull out five other texts on the same subject and read them all until I understood what they were saying. And it dawned on me that, hey, there are some authors who can write better than other authors. There are some charts and diagrams and photographs in other textbooks that are better than these books, you know. And in fact, there are some textbooks that use words to describe certain organs in biology that are different from other words that are being used in our text. I began cross-referencing like that and studied. I became a really good student. In fact, as you all were aware yesterday, I indicated I was very, very visual. That's how I got into Brooklyn Tech. Well, when I looked in those microscopes, I would remember everything. I could see everything. And in our first lab test, after biology there's only geology left, you know. the biology department organized itself for a freshman for the first year course, all the sections were taking the same exams and getting all the same materials. So out of about 300 students in the first semester biology class, my test scores, I was number one. Jeez. And then, or number two, but never one or two. And the other person was Eunice Wenger, and you know, who is she, you know, who was always competing with me for the top-notch spot. I must get to know her. And I did get to know her. In fact, I did very well that year. In fact, I did so well, I don't think I studied any more in biology. I became a biology major. If this is the only success story you've got, you better lay all your eggs here. Became a biology major, did very well in that department. And in fact, at the end of my sophomore year, I even had the nerve to apply for a laboratory assistance job in the biology department, and I got the job. And became a tutor in that department, and in my senior year was elected president of the biology club. So that was a success story that I prize and value immensely. And there were teachers in that department who were enormously supportive and helpful. They kind of keep track of your social life and your personal life as well, so they knew quite a lot about you. That's one of the advantages, I think, of one of our small church colleges. They were very supportive, and in fact, last October, I was invited to preach at the chapel at Valparaiso, and it was during the week of the, there was a whole series of inaugural events for the new president there. And so I preached that week, and Dr. Bloom, who was chairman of the biology department, was there to greet me. And we had a nice reunion there for a while. So biology helped me pull through. I kind of joke wistfully when I look back, you know, you take plant morphology, systematic botany, comparative anatomy, and you take all those courses. And it dawned on me that the foundation for all those courses were developed when I took that first course, when I began just studying like crazy to survive in the academic setting. What other successes did I have there? In my freshman year, was elected president of the Empire State Club. We had students from all over the 48 states in the country, and so they had social clubs by state. And in my junior year, I ran for vice president of the student government and won. And I even had some faculty members in the biology department make posters for me. I have one guy, Dr. Nichols, make a skeleton for me, will you, and put it in this closet, you know. And so he did that. And social life, I think probably the most painful experiences I had there occurred a number of times. Once with respect to fraternities, and once with respect to a play that I wanted to try out for, and then once just walking on campus, and they were very, very significant events. When we were freshmen, you know, all the guys were living in the dorms, and then one night someone said, hey, the auditions are going on for our town, you know. My roommate was going, and some of my good friends from New Jersey and the East Coast were going, and so I'll go along too. Because when we were in the Boy Scouts, we used to do plays back in Chinatown, and we did Russian plays. And we did them at Trulite in our gym. The Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts would get together. These are all, you know, Chinese troops. And we did Russian plays. And of course, we had grade school, high school teachers who did all the directing, and we put on shows, and we would sell tickets, raise a lot of money for the troupe. So I've enjoyed being in drama. So I said, well, let's all go out for the play. So I did. And I think it was it was very painful to be told, sorry, Jim, the cast won't fit. You won't fit the casting. And Van Cusero was one of our drama teachers who broke the news to me. And my best friend, who eventually became my best man at my wedding, got the lead role And I was very happy for him, and in fact, attended all of the rehearsals with him. And a few months after the initial cut, I received a phone call from Van Cusserow, and he asked, Jim, I think we have a role for you. So I took it. I played the man in the audience. Well, you know, I tell you, it was kind of, you know, I'm those of you who know the Myers-Briggs might recognize, I know I'm a T, I'm a thinker. I could be very rational and logical, and I can understand that the typecasting would be wrong, you know. But it was just extremely painful to be told that you don't fit. And many years later, in fact, about just 2-3 years ago, my wife enrolled in the Sound Actors Workshop in Seattle, a professional school for teaching drama acting, which she loved and enjoyed. And we had a chance to share these kinds of feelings and stereotyping and the limitations placed on the Asian in this society. And I experienced it back then. And you kind of put those sad feelings away. You kind of repress it. And it didn't really come out again until my wife said she wanted to go and learn some acting. Then I began pouring out all this, all these feelings I had at the time when I was basically rejected. Another occasion came when it came to pledging fraternities. This was back in the early 50s. And all my friends were pledging all these fraternities, and they were throwing all these parties to recruit the pledges. And I was invited to all the parties. And then the fraternity where all my friends went, including Ed Dursick, who was my best friend, the same fellow who had the lead role in Our Town, they said that they couldn't pledge me, but they couldn't get the National to make an exception in my case, and they tried. And so they made me an informal honorary associate member. I was free to attend all their parties and drink their booze and go to their dances and attend all their events. The only thing I don't need to do is pay their dues, which was kind of a good deal. So I stayed with that group socially for about 2.5 years. And then there were about a dozen of us on campus, a Hispanic fella, a black fella, myself, and a number of other law students who decided to form a new fraternity, a multicultural one, which we did. And that fraternity still exists today, and I think they've gone national, but that was my experience there. And again, I don't think that the pain that was there was recognized by myself at the time when it occurred. I think it was, again, many years again later on when I was more in touch with my own feelings, when you look back in those days and say, boy, what a rotten deal it was. Pretending to be a member of that fraternity when, for all practical purposes, you weren't. And everyone else trying to pretend that everything was okay when it wasn't, but yet no one was in a position to deal with it. And the third experience I had was kind of an interesting one. When I was a freshman at Valpo, I used to go to the cafeteria and just watch like a hawkeye with my visual eyes, watching how these Midwesterners ate with their forks. I didn't know how to eat with a fork, you know. And I watched and I said, oh, so that's how you pick up rice with a fork, you know. Or also, that's how they pick up peas with a fork. You know, they kind of mash it, you know, the last tidbits they would mash it and put it in their mouth. We had no idea how to use forks. But those were just little pieces of insight that I remembered. At that time, I consciously, no, I can't say consciously. I was unconsciously trying to be like everyone else, and unconsciously trying to be accepted and to be woven into the Valparaiso family. And I thought that it worked pretty well. You know, I could begin talking English fairly well and was elected into offices and got some recognition that way, and feeling very happy, had lots of friendships on campus, and socially was dating a lot of the co-eds on campuses, and felt more so than ever before really thriving as an individual, until out of the clear blue sky one day in the middle of the campus, some of the neighborhood kids who were riding bicycles would zip by and shout, "Chinky Chinky Chinaman!" You know. And I remember when it was done, I think I was a senior by then. When it was done, I said to myself, "Whoa, he's right, I am Chinese." And as soon as I said that to myself, I became terribly aware that I had been trying to be not Chinese. And in fact, I remember in my sophomore year when I was doing so well and coming back to school, coming back home and sharing all these things with my parents, my father said, "Don't you forget. You are Chinese." Mm. You know, when he said that, as a 20-year-old, you know, you kind of resent your father telling you, telling you these things. What was really funny, several days ago, sometimes last week, I had a dream. And told Mabel about this dream. I said, "You know, I dreamt that I was visiting with some of the daughters of my, brothers, some of my nieces. And in the dream, one of my nieces ran by, and we talked about some things about her going to school, etc. And I remember saying to my niece, 'Don't you forget, you are Chinese.'" I said that in my dream. Can you imagine that? I shared that with Mabel, and she said, well, her response was, well, see, both of us have gone into Jungian psychology a lot. We both have taken courses in dream analysis and all these kinds of things. And Mabel's response was, well, it is true, you are the oldest remaining son in the clan, and you're assuming your father's role now. I thought that was interesting. I mean, in my dream, I said to the little kid, "Don't you forget you are Chinese." You know? I thought that's a wonderful coming around for myself in terms of my maturation. Ming, it takes about 40 years. Anyway, I also had gotten a job as a residence hall counselor. So that the full experience I had at Valparaiso were really wonderful. I entered it with a very, very low self-concept, pretty low opinion of myself and what I was able to do, and was completely lacking in self-confidence, and gradually changed with every small success. I give all the credit to Valparaiso, really. O.P. Kretzmann, who was president at that time, was kind of like the great granddaddy of the institution. And when I was a senior, almost all the student leaders were invited to take his class in Christianity and Modern Problems. Very clever, clever man to offer a course like that, especially with all the student leaders. Because basically what it did was give him an audience into the student culture and gave him an opportunity to interpret all the policies of the management and all the trends that were going on. And he called it Christianity and Modern Problems, but it was probably what I would call ethics and the Christian life and running a university. Basically, that's what it was. And he invited us to his home for Christmas. And that was when we met Jody Kretschmann, who's here now, when he was a little boy. And at the end of one of our classes, I did talk to him and asked that Dr. Kretschmann, I was considering the ministry and asked him what he thought, whether there would be any cause for me. Very, very, very concerned with that. Whether my being Chinese would stop me from getting a call in the church. And he looked at me and, don't worry about that. That should be the least of your considerations. There will be many, many opportunities for you in the church. And so he encouraged me to go on to seminary. So what can I say about all of that? Probably one of the most significant pieces of information that was derived during my senior year was a class with Dr. Elsa Dronberger, who I quoted her yesterday, who had gotten us into an exercise on the characteristics of the rejected child. But more importantly, in her lectures on the marginal person, it was as if a person had turned on the lights for me in a dark room. And I like to spend some time talking about that, those characteristics in her lecture. And in many ways highlight the difficulties a Chinese American such as I, and many to follow, many who have gone before me and who will follow after me, experience. And that is the whole process of acculturation in this country and whether it works or not. Dronberger was fascinating because she introduced a lot of material on the qualities of the marginal person. Marginality, marked by contact with disparate cultures, and acquiring some but not all the traits or values common to any one of them. So you're right on the edge of everything. The marginal man. I guess today we can update and call it the marginal person. A person who participates only slightly in the life of two cultural groups without feeling identified with either group, and that was me. It was there has been an enormous amount of research done by sociologists in this area, and the sample populations used are especially those people who are biracial, who might have had fathers and mothers of different races. And the populations chosen were from Hawaii because there were a lot of good examples there, but the other samples picked in university settings to identify their personalities and psychological characteristics and interviews of these people. And it's the sort of thing that is stated that the marginal person becomes, the person experiences the kind of ambivalence that Paul Nakamura had mentioned with the closing poem that he had today, where you thought you were one and not the other. You know, are you an American or you're Japanese, or you're American or Chinese? And you say, I'm an American. No, but you're Chinese. Or you tell them you're Chinese, but I thought you were an American, you know. It's this bouncing around back and forth between the two cultures. And we experienced so much of that when we were growing up. And we used to have all these conflicts with our parents when we would come home and be very proud and say to our parents, I'm an American, because that's what teacher have just said today. And my dad would say, oh, you dummy, take a look in the mirror and tell me if you're an American or not. So dad, you know, was very, very pragmatic and was, of course, not given to, he was not going to concede anything to the Americans. And that conflict continued on continuously throughout all of those adolescent years. One of the most interesting things is that when I heard these wonderful jokes being told, either on a television or heard over the radio, I would try and translate. My mother would say, what are you laughing about? I would try to translate the joke into Chinese, and, you know, it's a dud. Invariably a dud. My mother would look and say, that's kind of stupid to be laughing at things like that. There, I think what I did, which was a mistake, was that I tried to do everything and be everything and say everything and act everything as if I was Caucasian. And so you polish off your speech, you use your knives and forks properly, you learn how to dress like the way everyone else dresses on campus, and you go on these parties and dates and dances, and you do everything that is unique to the Western culture. And you thought, hooray, I've been accepted, I'm one of them, and then you're reminded very drastically, no, you're not. Or better yet, when we were at seminary at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, my wife and I were shopping at one of the five and dime stores, and an elderly gentleman would come up very, very friendly and with a big smile, warm smile on his face, with the best intentions of the world, come and say, well, how do you like this country? And we're Asians, so we're very polite, you know, and we would say, oh, we feel like it fine. Forget it. And I would say to Mabel, if, you know, my militant black friends would say, oh, I hate this country. In first place, I don't think that gentleman would have even dared approach a black man to ask him, how do you like this country? So there are those kinds of differences that you experience, and these ambivalences of the culture. The net effect is that a marginal person, especially one who by genes, a gene pool of two races, they will experience the same kinds of things that I've described, even in a more intense way. And when Dr. Dronberger gave this lecture, I saw myself there, and I immediately felt empathy for many of my friends who were half Italian and half Chinese. We had lots of half and half friends who grew up in Chinatown. And one of my dearest friends, whom I had gone to ballet class together with, is a girl who was half Caucasian and half Chinese. And her brother, you know, her whole family were half and half. And we have maintained correspondence and communication with one another over the years. And we've talked about their growing up in the same way. And I remember at the time when I got this lecture in college, I wondered, oh, what was happening with Ronald and Adrian and Maxine, all of the kids in Chinatown who were growing up with us. And in their cases, their parents made a specific decision to raise them as if they were Chinese. And there were a lot of learnings that came out of that. And I could probably share some of those later on. But what are those characteristics that Dornberger had used? Number one, there is what she called psychological distancing. They have an ability to see both sides of an issue. They do that all the time. An objectivity that sees good and evil in all these issues and positions. a reluctance to take sides, an ability to see contradictions are promulgated by one group or the other group, a sense of detachment from either group as a result of it, great sense of loneliness and isolation, strong desire for contact, but not at the price of giving up one's individuality. So there is this real contradiction. You long to be with someone, and yet at the same time you're not sure that person will ever fully understand you by stepping into your shoes.
Those are characteristics of
the marginal person.
I feel some of those are in me too.
Yeah. The result is that the marginal person makes a wonderful therapist. And many go into human services professions, teaching and counseling, psychology and counseling, because as you have just admitted, some of the characteristics I've described here, we all experience as human beings, but the marginal person experiences it more intensely and therefore can empathize to a greater degree in helping people in terms of empathy and understanding. It's a wonderful characteristic, wonderful people. When you see these analyses and these observations and profiles, you begin realizing that these are the gems of the earth, because they have a super ability to understand diversity in a way that most of us cannot, because most of us are limited in one way or another. But because of their marginality, they were raised that way. There is some sense of loneliness, especially as teenagers, because they're never part of a group. I guess in that sense, parents with marginal children need to be especially sensitive to their development and in the search for identity during these years. There's a lot of acting out during that period, because they are neither fish nor fowl. And, yes?
You know, I'm Austrian. I mean, I come from Austria, and my husband comes from England. And our children, not so much our son, but our daughter makes it a point of telling people right away she's half Austrian and she's half English, but she was born here. Mm-hmm. But so I wonder, she seems to go the other way. She, rather than hiding it, she wants to advertise it, you know? It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think with that bicultural background, I think with that kind of bicultural background, that she probably would have also the sensitivity that would be unique to a marginal person like that. Trying to fit the values and the behaviors of the majority into my life as best as I can, trying to make sense of that, trying to survive academically, and in the process trying to make sense of where my life was to go from that place on.
Where did you get your master's and your PhD?
I'll speak about that tomorrow. Tomorrow, the topic I gave it, I called it career development. But when I began outlining my journey, it dawned on me that what I might call career development is in many ways an attempt to weave my being Chinese into this culture in a theologically acceptable way. because I had experienced a call in wanting to serve Christ as a minister when I was very, very young. I was not able to make that decision. Some of you may know, in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, it is possible for a 13-year-old to enter into their preparatory school system as a pre-theological major. So, and that was the route I was going to choose. That was not available to me, and in many ways, hindsight is wiser, and I'm glad that did not occur. Because I think the subsequent experiences I had are far richer. Instead of pursuing a narrow theological journey from the age of 13 on and up, I think the role identity for a clergyman being shaped from that age on is extremely narrow and results in a lot of role expectations that are just rigid. So I didn't have that, but I did make that decision after college. I was free to do that. And tomorrow, what I will share with you is that journey. My going to seminary, and I've attended three seminaries. I'm quite an expert on seminaries, on faculty, on curriculum, and library, and the kind of environment that I found that was conducive and helpful towards my completing seminary. And moved from there to the parish, and my experiences there, and the subsequent decision to go on to graduate school.
When did you marry?
I'm glad you asked that question, because in my whole outline I did not plug that piece anywhere. So this is a good time to do it. When I was a senior at Valparaiso University, I became terribly aware that my journey has ended there, and made another decision. You remember I said in my freshman year I decided to cut off my past. I made the decision that I'm going to cut off Valparaiso now. And I decided to do that because when I was a senior, or when I was a sophomore, junior, senior, I saw so many alumni coming back to the fraternity houses to take part in their parties. I said to myself, grow up, you know? I said, you know, I don't want to see these graduates coming in to mix with undergraduates. I said, why don't they just cut the umbilical cord, grow up, you know? So I said, I'm not going to allow that to happen to me. When I graduate, I'm out, and I'm off to another life. So when I did that, I said, I got to get back into circulation in Chinatown. So I went back home and contacted old friends whom I had lost touch with, and asked them to introduce me to some eligible young ladies. That's what I did. And my very good friend, young woman by the name of Janice Chin, who was the daughter of my former basketball coach, who was always in love with me, but I didn't know, I was too dumb, you know. Janice pulled out her address book and, yeah. So I met Mabel that way. And it was really a marriage of contrasts and opposites. Mabel was a valedictorian in high school. Now, a valedictorian in the New York City high school system, you're talking about a senior class of 4,000 people, so she did very well. And of course I knew who she was, because in Chinatown, back in the early 50s, the Chinese community kept an eye out for every one of its scholars. They knew who was doing well in the public schools. And when she became valedictorian, everyone talked about it. And I remember saying to myself, oh well, I know who she is, but that was about all. I met her after college then, and we just began dating. Blind date. Started off on a blind date.
What college? Belfries?
No. She was a graduate of Brooklyn College.
Oh, okay.
And she was very active with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and grew up not as a Lutheran, but very active in her own church in Brooklyn. And when she joined InterVarsity, that became her church, in effect, until she met me. And then we spent a lot of time discussing theology, lots of times. But she should really tell her story, because she has a completely different picture about the way we met. Completely different story. Yes.
Maybe you can comment on this. I'm not sure how to phrase the question, but I can kind of tell an incident. We live in Honolulu, and there are students that come from China, from mainland China, to work and study at the university. And they make the comment that it's interesting for them to mingle with the Chinese in Hawaii because they teach them about their culture. That these young people who grew up now under the communist regime know nothing about a lot of the Chinese culture.
Well, that's interesting. That's understandable, too. Uh-huh.
And then we also, on that same line, we had friends who visited us in Honolulu who were Japanese. And the wife had been born and raised in Tokyo, and the husband had been born and raised in Brazil with the Japanese colony that's there, and they had been teaching in the United States and had two small children. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, they spoke Japanese, English, and Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
We noticed, though, when they disciplined the children, they disciplined them in
Chinese.
Japanese.
Yes.
The other conversation. But she had said her husband was so old-fashioned. She said the Japanese in Brazil did things that nobody in Tokyo thinks or does anymore at all. She termed it old-fashioned culture.
It has really varied. The Chinese communities in the United States differ significantly. The ones in New York and Boston, I would characterize as being very traditional and very conservative. The ones on the West Coast, such as San Francisco, I would characterize as being far more progressive and much more ready to abandon the old ways. And I think it has to do with quantity. When you have a small group like that, the immigrant generations were eager to hold on and simulate the homeland there, which is what they did. What was interesting was that, of course, with the passing of time, life in Hong Kong changed. And my aunt had occasion to go back to China once, back to Hong Kong. She came back completely disillusioned. They had grown corrupt. It's not the China I knew. She preferred the Chinatown in New York City much more because it's like the old Hong Kong she knew. Is that true? You nod your head. So it really has varied. And pardon me?
What is culture then? What do we... It's moving always, isn't it?
Yeah, there is. And many of the traditions that were practiced without reason or logic, you just do it because you do it, and you're told to do it. That's tradition. Well, a lot depends on how strictly that's adhered to. And in our family, my mother adhered to it less than Mabel's mother. My mother-in-law was much more traditional than my mother. And we can tell when we were getting ready to marry, there were just a lot of rituals that my mother did and lots that her mother did. And when we compare them, we can say, oh, well, we can see some have gone, some have been terribly Americanized. they've lost some of the old practices.
Are all of the major centers of Chinese in the United States, predominantly Cantonese, Hong Kong?
Yes, up until the mid-60s, they were all predominantly Cantonese. And in fact, I've alluded to these family associations earlier in the history of this country in the 20s. These family associations went to war against one another, you know, these Tong battles that took place in Chinatowns. They've done away with the battles, but the family associations were still intact. And they provided the networks a person might need when they hopped ship in San Francisco and then sort of moved from one community to another till they got to the East Coast. It's the family networks that help support and sustain them that way. In the mid-60s, a lot of your Shanghai and Northerners and Mandarin and Taiwanese people began coming here. You could probably trace that with the emergence of Mandarin restaurants, Hunan restaurants, Sichuan restaurants. This country had never seen any of those until the late 60s.
The ones in our community are all run by Koreans now.
Yeah. Many of the Koreans, of course, in the geography, the Koreans were very attached to the mainland, and many of them know how to prepare Chinese foods. Any other questions?
Do you have children?
Yes, we have two.
And how do they feel? Do you? It's a different
good question.
Time. Yeah.
I think the other day, I forget what discussion group, I think my children, who one is 27 and the other is 24, I think they're still practicing denial. Denial. I think the younger one might be more sensitive to the kinds of things that we've talked about the past several days, because I have devoted more time to talking about these matters with the younger one, because it happens that he was home with us longer. Mm-hmm. And the older one left sooner, and we've not had a chance to enter into concerns like that. It'd be interesting for us to talk to them to find out what the experiences are. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I just don't understand racism. It's just about that. I must say that I don't know. I think I told you earlier that I don't know any other races personally. But how can I dislike you? For what reason? Why are people? Is it fear in people who have these feelings towards other people? I have no reason to judge you.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is a whole series of body of material on racism that's pretty interesting.
I have Norwegians that live by me that I wish would move off. You want to move in?
To do a quick summary, you know, there is a racism kind of on a one-by-one racism, but then there is what we call institutional racism that is a little different. And it may have nothing to do with people's feelings toward one another, but it might have everything to do with who holds the power and who makes decisions and shape and influence whole bodies of people. Yes, Al, one more question, then we have to break up for Tai Chi next door.
Well, back to Gilbert for a minute.
Yeah.
Based on your experience, what practical suggestion do you have to help prepare kids for discrimination?
To prepare children?
Prepare your children to cope with discrimination.
To cope with it. Well, someone asked me that question yesterday as well, because in the process of their growing up, we took it as it came. And when my younger son went back to Waverly, Iowa, and reported how some kids made fun of him, you know, by pulling the eyes and making fun like that, he didn't like it, and he was just expressing his frustrations and anger. He was only 11 years old when he experienced them all. And our response to him was, well, Tommy, you know, we were very supportive. We understood him, and we hugged him, and we said, well, you know, there are some people who just are stupid and dumb, aren't they? And he would agree, yes. And that was about all. We did not make an issue of it in terms of going into long lectures and long discussions and focus on that, and we didn't go into discussions on what they should do if it should happen again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We did not do any of those kinds of things. I think one reason is that we wanted them to really know what it's like and to develop some coping skills of their own to deal with it and to accept it as a natural course of events. Nothing special. Don't make it into a big deal. And in other words, we're trying to help give them some balance and focus. Because I think if we had overbalanced it in the other way and given them a whole arsenal to prepare them for all these terrible things that are going to happen, I think an 11-year-old emotionally would not be in a position to deal with all of that. And it's not necessary for them to deal with that. So they've basically grown up in what I would consider a relatively anger-free, hostile-free environment. We did, as parents, decide that when they reached their teenage years, we should be in an urban cosmopolitan area.